Welcome to Impact, the show about individuals and groups making a positive difference in the community. This is a pre-recorded show. The views and opinions expressed on Impact are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio, nor Henry Ford College. This is WHFR Dearborn. Hi, I'm your host, Lynn, and today we're discussing the First Step program of Wayne County with Teresa Bizzo, Associate Director of First Step. Teresa, thank you for being here today. Welcome.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
This is an organization that's been around for a long time. Tell me a little bit about the history.
Sure. Well, First Step is an organization that started back in 1978. So we've been around for decades, and we were started because back then, when a victim was assaulted by their partner, there was no place for them to turn. The police were not very responsive. The church community, the government agencies, there were not nonprofits around to help. And there was a group of women from the National Organization of Women that got together and created a task force to look at the issue of domestic violence and the lack of response in the community. And eventually that committee of women ended up becoming our first board of directors.
Oh.
So they started, our first office was in the back of Westland City Hall. And back then people answered the helpline and they tried to put families up if they needed a safe place to stay in hotels. And we had almost all volunteers except for a very small number of paid staff. And that's where we began.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's been for many, many decades, and there have been a lot of changes, but unfortunately the problem still exists, and there is still a strong need for our services in the community today.
Have the laws changed over the years to better protect the abused?
Yes.
Whether that's male or female?
Yeah, the laws have significantly changed, and it's much better today than it was 30 years ago. Back then, police actually had to witness the violence. So when they would get there to the site, and they would see the evidence of assault, and they would say, well, there was no one here to witness the crime, so, they couldn't press charges. And the spouse had to press charges against the assailant.
Mm-hmm.
So now there are a lot more laws in place to really protect victims, to hold perpetrators accountable. But sadly, it still is a very underreported issue, and there's a lot of gaps that still exist. So very few people who are assaulted either physically or sexually actually even call the police.
Hmm.
And when people, particularly sexual assault victims, when they go forward with prosecution, very few of them actually even ever go to trial. Because there are some real strong challenges with, the legal system, with evidence that's required, and sometimes the victims themselves feel like they're on trial when they go through the process as well. So it's very complicated.
Right.
But the laws are much better. And most importantly, I think that the word is out. That people know that there are places like First Step and our sister organizations like Haven or Interim House or Safe House that can provide support services. They know that the police are actually required to give a little card with the resource phone numbers of the shelters when they go out on a call. And so, people are more aware of resources that are available, but it still is a very dangerous time for victims, and people do really need a lot of support when they do decide to stop and to leave because they're at a much higher risk of actually being killed at that time.
Wow. I've seen little cards and things in various ladies' rooms, restaurants, and that sort of thing, too, where you can call if you have a problem and you're trying to run.
Right.
How long does it take for, let's say somebody is at a restaurant, they're locked in the bathroom at McDonald's, for example, or some other restaurant, and they call you for help, and they say, I'm hiding out in the restroom. How long does it take to get help?
Well, help is just at the other end of the phone, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a lot of times, if people are in a dangerous situation, we actually encourage them to work with the police first before they call us because, if somebody's locked in the bathroom and they're afraid for their life and their perpetrator's outside banging on the door,
mm-hmm.
You can't have, staff and volunteers rush in.
Right.
You need police intervention.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the number one thing we encourage people to intervene by calling the police, whether you're the victim themselves that are calling 911 or a bystander. I mean, there's a huge part of this that in the old days and even today, a lot of people think of domestic and sexual abuse as something that's not in anybody else's business. And people are afraid to make that call. Mm-hmm. But what we try to do is encourage people to say, to call police, to call 911, to get involved in some way that's going to keep them safe, but mm-hmm. also help the victim to get the services that they need.
Somehow the victim has to know that it's not okay for this to keep happening.
Right. Yeah. So First Step has a team of what we call assault responders on call 24/7 every day of the year.
Okay.
So this is a team of specially trained counselors and advocates that actually go out to sites like police departments. So in your example, a woman is in a McDonald's bathroom fearing for her life. The staff at McDonald's is concerned. They dial 911. The police come out. The police would give them our phone number, and that the victim, whether at the McDonald's or at the police department, would call our helpline, 24-hour helpline, tell them a bit about the story, what's going on, and we would help to assess what their needs are. So if that person needs a safe place to stay, we might work with them on providing shelter. First Step provides shelter for survivors. So we would provide that. They might just need somebody to talk to. They might have a safe place that they can go. They might be able to stay at their mother's house or maybe a friend that is unknown to the abuser. So that might be the best plan for them. But whenever anybody in that situation calls our 24-hour helpline, our advocates will do what's called a safety plan with them. So we help to determine what the lethality is, what the potential for lethality, and things that they can do to keep themselves safe in their home. Sometimes if somebody calls 911 at home and they can't leave, we even do a safety plan with people who have to remain in the home, because sometimes it's not the right time to leave. Sometimes it could be very dangerous for them to leave at that time, or it's not the right time for them. So we'll do a safety plan to help them see how to be more safe in your home, to pack a bag with your, papers that you might need, documents that you might need, some money that, you can have, important phone numbers, those kinds of things, and maybe store that bag at a friend or a relative's house so that when you can get out with your children, you can.
Mm-hmm.
So our staff will do a personal safety plan with everybody who calls. So that's an important feature. But the most important feature is to actually talk to somebody who understands domestic and sexual violence, somebody who's an expert at it, somebody who knows the laws. They know the effect that this trauma has on the human spirit. They've worked with, we've worked with hundreds of survivors who have been able to get through the situation and to move their families from violence to safety. So by calling our helpline, our advocates can help people explore what their options are. When they call us, we're not going to say, you know what, you need to get out, you need to leave, you need to pay. We let people make their own decision. We're victim-centered. So we help the person look at all their options. If we're afraid for them, we'll say, we're very afraid for your safety. Your case here sounds very lethal. You know, there's things that we hear on the crisis line that help us to know that it's a very dangerous situation. If the person has threatened suicide, that's a very dangerous situation. If they've threatened to kill the victim or their children, very highly lethal. If they're, they have guns in the house. If they're they've abused pets and things, as part of the intimidation, that's very lethal. So there's certain things that we know that research has shown that increases the lethality of a case. So we'll help victims to understand that. And there are other things, too. There's other kinds of control that's not necessarily physical violence. So if somebody's been threatened, if they're controlled socially, they're not allowed to see their parents or their relatives or not allowed to have friends, or if the person is watching them, very jealous, calling their work, trying to get them fired, all these different parts of power and control, that also plays into the situation as well.
Wow. How do the families stay together? You have a parent, and we'll use the generic parent, could be male, could be female, and that individual is trying to keep four kids together and have them all escape at the same time. How do you accommodate the kids, and pets?
Mm-hmm.
Because pets, as you mentioned, pets are often, I'm going to hurt the cat because that hurts you,
mm-hmm.
without any regard at all for what that pain is being, caused to the animal.
Right, right. Well, our whole goal at First Step is to help people be safe.
Mm-hmm.
And to have healthy relationships and peaceful lives. So more than 50% of our shelter residents are children. So we do serve a significant number of children in our facility.
Okay.
So we also provide counseling for children that are not in our shelter. So if there's a family that's thinking of leaving and they're worried about the abuse that their child has witnessed, they're worried about the effect that this has had on their kids, if their teenagers have tried to intervene and break up the fights, you know, we have advocates that are specially trained to work with those children that will talk with them, help them understand how to be safe, help them understand that it's not their fault. A lot of children internalize that abuse, and they think, you know, it's their fault, or they can stop, or they can help it, you know, in some situations. So, and sadly, a lot of the children that are raised in violent homes become more like the adults themselves. You know, a lot of children really have to, you know, they lose their childhood because they're having to protect everyone in the family and try to keep the peace and try to keep, you know, the abuser from exploding, you know. So we do our best to try to keep, you know, the families together, to keep the children safe. You know, sometimes if you've got older teenagers, they might decide to stay with a relative or stay sometimes even in the home with the abuser. So, you know, it's very complicated, you know, these relationships. And it's complicated even more by, it's complicated even more by a technique that batterers often use, using the children against the victim. So they'll try to sow seeds of discourse in the family, making them think that the mom's crazy, making them think that the mom is, you know, the bad guy in the situation. And I'm using the word mom, but I really do mean, because First Step does serve men that are abused as well. Mm-hmm. But mostly, probably 95% of our primary victims are female. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, I just want to put that out there. But there's been some research done by a therapist named Lundy Bancroft, who's worked for years in batterers counseling. And he's got a book out called Why Does He Do That? And it really does talk about, you know, the techniques that batterers use to gain power against the victims. And a lot of that, on his website, they do a lot of things about how they use children for that as well. So we work with the kids to help break that cycle and to help them feel safe and love, and help them even in school, help them, you know, get their lives back, you know.
Right, right. That was exactly what I was thinking about with school. With all this, I hate to use the word drama, but with all this drama going on in the household, how is a child expected in any way, shape, or form to study, to do homework, to put together a science experiment? How do you do that in a crazy household like that?
It's challenging, and there's a lot of very high rates of depression amongst children. There's a high rate of illness among children in families where violence is present. There's a significant amount of health issues and even obesity in families where abuse is happening. If you think about it, how can you as a child feel safe if your primary caretaker is being beaten every day? I mean, even if you're not being beaten yourself as a child, the stress that puts on a person's physical being is just, you know, very, very challenging. So that's why it's important that people intervene. When school counselors notice this, when neighbors notice it, you know, to go to talk to the victim and say, look, this is not right. I'm worried about you. I'm worried about your children. How are you doing? You know, there's places that can help, places like First Step. You know, give them our 24-hour helpline number. Encourage them to call any time, day or night. You know, just to talk, you know, to get information about steps that they can take. So I think it's very important for all of us, you know, who care about, you know, just other human beings to have, you know, that information. I always encourage people, we have these little pocket cards, and it's got a list of our services on there, and also our 24-hour helpline and our website. And we encourage people to keep these in your purse or your wallet, because you never know when you're going to run into somebody that might need our help. So I go to an exercise class, and one of the instructors one day was saying this woman came running across through her yard barefoot in her pajamas at night, who had been just horribly abused, and she didn't know what to do. And so I was telling her, you know, if you keep this phone number handy, if you're in a restaurant, if you're in a public place, you're in the college cafeteria and you see somebody, you'll have a tool that you can give them and say, look, it's not right what's happening to you. I'm worried about you. call this number, and there's some people out there at the other end of this line that can help. Mm-hmm. So,
okay, let's run through the scenario of steps that happen. So here's a mom and two kids, and they call the emergency line. It's time to escape, and dad is at work, and it's a time when they can actually leave without being hurt.
Right.
Okay, so they leave, and they go to first step.
Well, we usually kind of have them come to a safe place, which I'm not going to tell you exactly where it is, but it's a safe place, and then we have them come in from there and do an assessment. When the people first come in, you know, they're welcome, they're given food and drink and, you know, just a few minutes just to, you know, relax and chill out.
Yeah.
And then we get them settled in their room. Our families usually get some kind of a welcome packet that has, you know, toiletries and a notebook, a journal for them to keep track of things. The kids will get a little packet that has teddy bears and those kinds of things. Our rooms are very welcoming. Several years ago, we built a brand new shelter facility that's beautiful, and it's a very welcoming place. It's a very warm place, and then sometimes it takes people a few days to kind of get settled in before they can start into the deep counseling and working, planning to start their new lives. And but we do provide all that kind of support. As soon as somebody enters our shelter, they're assigned an advocate. Somebody sees them right away, helps them get the rest that they need, medical attention that they may need. We start working on all the legal steps if the person chooses to do any type of legal action against a perpetrator. And then we start looking for safe places for them to stay, counseling. The children get enrolled in counseling and enrolled in school. And so we try to get, you know, some type of routine established as quickly as possible.
Okay. I don't want specific locations, but where are the safe houses? Is this like my house and I have the family come in because they're safe and they're with me for a while away from the abuser? Or are these empty homes or group homes?
Well, First Step runs a shelter. We can house up to 50 people any given night. So our capacity usually runs between 40 and 50 people.
Okay.
Any given night. And then we also have a number of transitional housing units, and those are usually apartments where people can go once they leave the shelter.
Okay.
So any given night, we're sheltering 40 to 50 people in our shelter, plus probably 11 to 15 families in our transitional housing units.
Okay.
And then, that's, you know, that's where people stay, is at our shelter.
Okay. All right. And then how long are they normally, if there is a normal, in the transitional housing? How long would a family stay there?
Well, our funding they can stay for up to 2 years based on the funding.
Okay.
So we get funding to that through the state, and so that helps us to shelter people for a little bit longer term. It's almost like the second step, not the first step. And while they're in transitional housing, they are assigned an advocate that works with them and their children to help them get situated. And we have a lot of people that are going back to school, getting degrees, job training, so that they can be self-sufficient.
Okay.
You know, we provide economic training, how to balance a checkbook. And we also work with the children doing all kinds of activities to help improve self-esteem, to help them understand healthy relationships, and really just to help them thrive when they're in this circumstance.
Right.
So hopefully after 2 years, people can really come out much, much further ahead.
Okay. So we have, potentially we have this abuser who is out there looking to find out what happened to the family. What steps do you take to make sure that abuser doesn't find the family?
Well, to be honest, in this day and age, it's really hard because we're in the age of technology.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got, you know, Google Maps, and you've got GPS trackers on phones and spyware that people can download from the internet. And so it's really hard.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that makes it really hard, too, is a lot of the court systems will give custody to abusive spouses. They'll give, you know, visitation rights. And so as long as the children are not abused by the assailant, they still provide that. So unfortunately, in many cases, families still have to really interact on a regular basis with the abuser. So that does complicate things.
Sure.
So in some cases, we work with our clients to get protection orders, personal protection orders. So, and it's just a pretty much a piece of paper, but it can help if there somebody is being stalked or harassed or, you know, threatened, mm-hmm. that you can document these things and the police have more evidence to be able to stop, you know, situations if they go down. So, you know, we help people with that. Sometimes we try to encourage our families to meet and exchange kids in safe places. So we've hired security companies to escort our survivors to the court systems in cases where it's been very dangerous. So we really do have to look at the situation. It is very difficult in the, you know, current environment, mm-hmm. with working with abusers.
Okay, so we have a child who is going from mom to dad, and it's a public place. And what happens if dad decides that this is it? He is in charge of the child, and he goes away. Has this happened before?
Well, it's happened. I mean, you see it on the news often.
Sure.
You know, so we all know it happens, and we try to help protect the kids and the, you know, parents as much as possible. So we try to work with our families and the court systems to have supervised visitation whenever possible in a safe place. It could be in the home of a grandparent or some other place. So we try to keep that as safe as possible. But again, every judge has a different perspective. Every case has a different perspective. So it is a very complicated and delicate situation, and when abuse is involved, it's always difficult. And so there always has to be usually an ongoing relationship with the parent of the children, mm-hmm. Even the abusive parent.
Right, right. Wow. We're going to take a little break, and I'll remind you that you are listening to IMPACT, the show about individuals and groups making a positive difference in the community. And today's edition, we are speaking to Teresa Abizzo about First Step program in Wayne County. And wow, it's been a real eye-opener so far. So we'll take a little break, and we'll be right back.
Ah, the many colors of the blues. And you can hear them on WHFR's latest blues compilation, Uncut Detroit 3, Live Studio Blues, featuring local artists Bugs Beto, Thornetta Davis, Eileen Orr, Kenny Parker, Robert Penn, Harmonica Shaw, and Joe Weaver. This CD has received great reviews, and we know that you will love it too. Support independent radio and order your copy of Uncut Detroit 3 Live Studio Blues for only $12. Go to our website at whfr.fm or give us a call at 313-845-9676.
And welcome back. You are listening to IMPACT, the show about individuals and groups making a positive difference in the community. And I'll remind you that this is a pre-recorded show. Joining us now is Ailsa Blanc, and she's going to talk a little bit about the whole pet equation, or how pets fit into this equation. We have an abusive parent. We have kids who are not knowing what to do, trying to stay in school, trying to study, trying to do all kinds of things. And one parent decides it's time to get out of harm's way and leaves and goes over to First Step. What happens to the cats?
Well, in a situation right now, the pets are left behind because there is no place at First Step for them to go. We're a committee of 12 women and many other volunteers who are working towards establishing a pet sanctuary on the grounds of First Step, mm-hmm. so that when families leave their abusers, they can bring their pets with them, and they can step right out the door of First Step, go 3 feet, and they'd be able to go into the ARC, which is Animals Receiving Kindness, into the building, and there'll be a place there for their pets. There'll be a family gathering area where they can enjoy each other's company, play with their children or with their pets, go for walks, and let that healing process begin.
Wonderful.
Right now, unfortunately, in many situations, they have to leave them behind where they're not sure if they're going to be abused. And
right.
Oftentimes, the families delay leaving their abuser because of fear of what will happen to their pet.
Sure, sure. What is your recommendation for someone? Do you recommend that they do try to take the animals out of the abusive home and maybe let them go someplace? Maybe they go to grandma's house, even though the parent and children end up in the shelter. But maybe is there a good place to park the pets?
Well, since we became aware of this need, which was about 2.5 to 3 years ago, mm-hmm. our committee has worked hard to establish relationships with vets and foster agencies so that when families do leave now, they can tell First Step they're going to be bringing their pet with them, and that's when we get a call and go into action.
Oh, okay.
And many of our committee members, including myself, have fostered these animals ourselves, or we've used vets to house them or foster agencies. Mm-hmm. And it's just a gratifying experience because at some point we're able to reunite those families wow. with their animals that they love so much.
Right.
But in the meantime, they have the peace of mind knowing their pet is safe, it's healthy, it's being well taken care of. We take them to First Step for visits. And so it's just a very nurturing relationship for everyone involved.
Right, fantastic. Talk about the volunteers, both of you. Talk about the volunteers that I'm sure you have to have to make this program work.
Sure. Well, we have volunteers in a wide variety of capacities at First Step. Everyone from committees like Elsa's ARC committee to volunteers that accompany victims to court. We have volunteers that will nurture and work with the children on site, help with homework, you know, do play therapy. We have volunteers that do fundraising events for us. We have volunteers that are trained as assault responders. And this is a very special group of people that go through a significant amount of training to be able to go out to hospitals and work with rape survivors or victims of violence on site at the hospital to help them understand what they're going to be going through, what their resources are, and provide support to those people at that most traumatic time in their life. So we have volunteers that go everywhere from answering the phone to assault responders to committee work. There's just a whole variety of ways to help.
So are the assault responders actually there at the hospital when the victim gets there, or pretty much about the same time?
Well, we're mobilized by a call from a healthcare provider, mm-hmm. from a victim in a hospital, or even from a police department or a
right.
school counselor, for instance.
Oh, okay.
So there might be a counselor at a high school that somebody comes in and discloses that they've just been sexually assaulted. Our first responder will go out to that high school and help to work with the victim at that time.
Okay.
So that's a very specialized group of volunteers, and it really takes a special person to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But we have volunteers that do everything from answer our phone at the mm-hmm. office to, we have people come and plant flowers, and we have we call it done in a day projects, where people come and they'll host a Mother's Day party for our families. They'll do crafts with the kids. They'll do activities with the children in the summer. So there's just a whole variety of ways to help, depending mm-hmm. upon, you know, the volunteer's expertise. Sometimes
right.
we have professional volunteers that come, and people who are skilled in marketing or accounting or, you know, other functions, building maintenance, and they'll help us in those ways.
Okay.
So even car repair, you know, that's a significant problem. We have clients that come with cars that are being held together with duct tape and
chewing gum.
And if we had somebody that could help them kind of get their cars in working order and repair, I mean, there's just a whole
right.
variety of needs that come up with survivors going through this. So we're always looking for people to help in different ways.
Do you take help from, volunteer help from community groups, church groups, that sort of thing too? So you're not coming in as an individual, but maybe 20 people show up on a Saturday morning to do something?
Oh yeah, that's a significant part of our volunteer program. There are many, many church groups and service clubs such as the Zonta Club and the Seroptimist Club, Rotary Clubs, Kiwanis Clubs, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Student groups even.
Mm-hmm.
Student groups from this campus, actually,
okay.
that come out and do things for our families.
Okay.
So we've had groups of students from this college come out and do collection drives for Christmas. And they brought gifts for our families at the holiday time.
Okay.
And there's just a whole variety of different things. But volunteer groups that's a great way to volunteer and to get groups involved. We also have volunteers that do fundraising for us. So, for example, coming up at the end of April, there's a group of veterinary medicine. They're doctors, and they're in an association of vet medicine. they're going to be doing a bowling event for First Step for their members.
Okay.
So they're hosting it at a bowling alley, and they're going to raise money, and they're going to give it to the ARC so that we can help to raise money to build this facility that we're trying to build.
Right.
It's not cheap. Construction's not cheap.
Right.
And the place that we're going to build is, as Elsa described, a really welcoming place for pets, but we're going to also add on to that a resource center that we can have a food pantry and a diaper depot and a clothing depot and a place to park vehicles for victims that it's not safe for their cars to be out in the parking lot, you know. So we're gonna use the ARC, and we're also going to use the money raised to build this entire resource center that will house the ARC and other agency needs. So we're trying to raise probably at least about $150,000 total that will fund the ARC program, but also the new building and facility that okay. we have to build. Because it has to be heated because of the pets. It has to be cooled. It has to have running water. And it has to be a really decent facility mm-hmm. to house all of our furry little beings that will be there.
How does one, as an individual or a representative for a group, how would one become involved? What do we do?
Well, to get involved, you just have to call our 24-hour helpline, which is 734-722-6800. Mm-hmm. And you can listen for the prompts, and there's a way to volunteer. And you just listen to the prompts, and they'll direct you to our volunteer coordinator. And tell them what you have in mind and what skills you have. And we offer training several times a year, where people who do training are the ones that work specifically directly with clients in a long-term basis.
Okay.
So we provide training on the dynamics of domestic violence and sexual assault, training on the laws, training on working with children who've been abused, training in safety and procedures. So there's a whole variety of trainings that we do provide our volunteers that come to us for help.
Wow.
We also take student internships as well.
Oh, okay.
So, and I'm sure we can always use more people to help with our ARC committee.
Yep.
Elsa has assembled a really great group of volunteers. Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot more information on the website as well.
And what is the website?
It's www.firststep-mi.org.
Okay. So we can find information there. We can call and get information. And humans actually answer the telephone.
Humans actually answer the telephone every day of the year. You can call us right after Christmas dinner, and we'll have somebody there that will answer the phone.
Okay. The big project right now is ARC.
Yes.
Are there any other projects you're working on? Any interesting fundraisers, for example?
Well, yeah. So right now we've raised a significant amount of money to build a beautiful playground on site.
Hmm.
So we have more than 50% of our residents of our shelter are children. So when they come to our shelter, they have to leave their toys, they have to leave their books, they have to leave their friends, their schools, and they come into this place at a scary time. And we really felt like we wanted to build a place where kids could be kids,
mm-hmm.
where when a mom brings a family into the shelter, that they would say, you know, this is a cool place for my kid. My kid's going to be okay here. So we had the help of a designer named Jonathan Dreyfus, who designed this beautiful playground for us. And it has all of the architectural features involved that are in a hospital healing garden. So this playground will have plants, beautiful garden areas. It's got age-appropriate areas for every child from toddlers all the way up to teenagers. And there's running water features and a central pavilion. And we're going to be able to use this facility to do counseling, to do activities with the kids. The moms can take their kids out and play. Mm-hmm. And it's right near where we're going to build the ARC.
Oh.
And so it's going to be a really, just a really spectacular and wonderful place. And we're almost completed with our construction. So we've got several volunteer groups coming out in the next month or two. And we're hoping to have our grand opening hopefully sometime in June if all goes well.
Okay. All right. One of the things I personally find very healing or therapeutic is to garden. To go out and get my hands in the dirt. Are the residents allowed to actually work in some of the gardens and be part of the their own helping? First Step is helping them, and they'd like to help First Step.
Yeah. So we've had several clients through the last few years. We've only been in our new building for a little over 3 years.
Okay.
And we've had several clients that like to garden. So. Mm-hmm. There was a volunteer that planted a big strawberry patch for us, so every spring we're able to go out and taste the strawberries that she's moved on, of course, but we're able to pick her strawberries for our residents, so that's wow. wonderful. And as part of the playground, we're going to be installing a pizza garden, which it's a circular-shaped garden with wedge-shaped sections okay. where you plant tomatoes and basil and oregano and all the different things that go on a pizza.
Okay.
And then we're going to have some raised garden beds so the kids can actually grow, you know, some vegetables that they might like and eat. And mm-hmm. So we do the gardening. We also have a partnership that we've done for the last several years with the Canton Community Garden with the farmer's market there, right. where they bring fresh right. produce and vegetables to our families. So we really try to encourage healthy eating and gardening, and there'll be lots of opportunities to help, both for our residents and also for volunteers that want to come and help us keep the garden areas really beautiful.
That's great. That is absolutely great. That is so, it's so holistic of a way of connecting the families, to connecting with the grounds, connecting with you mm-hmm, guys, mm-hmm. And everybody, yeah, everybody's working together. That's spectacular.
And you're so right, Lynn, about the residents of First Step wanting to give back, because mm-hmm. we've just seen that so much, even with the limited exposure we've had to the pets we've fostered. All those families have said when they're in a position, they want to foster an animal, they want to do something in return because they're so appreciative mm-hmm. of what we were able to do for them.
With regards to some of the safety issues related to the people who are there, both the children and the adults, you mentioned that sometimes the car has to be hidden so that the abuser can't find the mm-hmm. car. How are you secured? How are the grounds secured?
Well, we're secured as best that we can. So our new facility, when it was designed, had components including security cameras, you know, our fences secured. We buzz people in and out. We have just the general good security that you would have in any corporation, or because okay. pretty much violence can happen in any corporation. We've had local domestic violence homicides in different companies over the last several years in Southeast
yes.
Michigan. I mean,
yes.
there's medical centers and, you know, plants and different things.
Schools.
In schools. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, all the facilities really pretty much have to be on lookout for this type of situation.
Right.
But us, even more. So we've, you know, for many years, we've just had really good relationships with our local police departments. If we see suspicious cars or if we know we have a really dangerous assailant, we're really vigilant. We use our own safety precautions, and you know, we do the very best we can.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I always remember Teresa telling me, though, that life goes on. These people have to continue their lives. They can't just go into First Step and never come out again.
Right.
So they have to take children to school or go to the store, or go to a doctor's appointment. So that's the reality of it, and they do the best mm-hmm. they can, but you can't just be a prisoner in there.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. That's why I'm so happy to hear that there's so much activity going mm-hmm. on, and there's so much positive activity going on in there to try to make a child's life or an abused person's life as normal as possible. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going to take that out of their head.
And it's our hope, if somebody is really in a really dangerous situation, that we can hold the perpetrator accountable and get them locked up so that mm-hmm. they can no longer be of harm to their partner or mm-hmm. their children. So
right.
that's the ultimate goal.
Right, right. Okay, we talked about a lot of, this is so exciting. There's so many great things going on. I have one of your brochures, so I will say that. And, oops, there is a project out there called 100 Men Donors. What is that all about?
Well, we started this last fall. We feel that violence against women is not just a women's issue. It's a human issue.
Absolutely.
And that violence against women and girls is never going to stop unless all of us get involved, women and men. For many, many years, it's been seen as just a feminist issue. But in reality, men's sisters and grandmothers and daughters are being sexually assaulted and abused, and there are more good men out there than there are perpetrators.
Mm-hmm.
Most men are good men. So we started this campaign last fall to increase awareness of men about this issue and really trying to encourage people to give to donate funds, to be regular volunteers, to get involved in our mission. We do have men volunteers. We have men that come and play with the kids. We have men that work. We've had men that worked our crisis line. We've had male counselors. We use a lot of men in our movement, and we do believe that that's an important part of stopping violence against women, is getting the whole community engaged and saying this is not acceptable. And so we've been had a number of different donors contribute, and we've raised probably more than $20,000 in this campaign so far, and we're hoping to continue it each and every year and to grow our list. So if you're one of the good men out there and you'd like to contribute, you can find more information about that on our website.
Okay. And one more time, that website is?
It's firststep-mi.org.
Okay. Easy. Very easy. Mm-hmm. Okay. excuse me. Also wanted to talk about, you mentioned that you're getting a lot of men involved. How far does First Step go geographically? How far, you mentioned you started in 1978, and it was, I'm sure, a much smaller operation at that point. And now you're including, we're going to make this, like it's already happened, you're including animals and children and the abused spouses or significant others. How far does the program actually reach? We talked about Wayne County. Do you go into Oakland County at any point, or Macomb County, Monroe County?
Well, our primary service area is Wayne County.
Okay.
And there's another shelter in Wayne County as well called Interim House. Mm-hmm. But like our shelters in other counties, there's a shelter in Oakland County called Haven, and in Washtenaw County called Safe House, and Macomb County is Turning Point. So we work with our sister organizations, the other shelters.
Okay.
So sometimes if we've got a client that needs to relocate into Oakland County, mm-hmm. we work together with the other shelter. And likewise, if somebody from Oakland County is relocating to Belleville or Westland or something like that, we'll work with them in our shelter. Or if our shelters are full and there's vacancies in the other shelters, you know, so we do work very closely. We've also worked with people from all over the country. You know, somebody that's in Florida that's in a horrible abusive relationship, but their parents are up here in Michigan, mm-hmm. and they want to move back here, but it's not safe for them to move into their family yet. So we'll work with them in our shelter. So, you know, in a sense, we work with pretty much anybody that needs our help. But our primary service area is Wayne County, mm-hmm. and we work closely with the Wayne County courts. So, you know, that's how kind of we work.
Okay. So you are networked then throughout the country, and that's spectacular.
Sure.
How do you establish those relationships?
Well, there's a network of shelters throughout the country. There's a National Coalition Against Domestic Violence produces, you know, the phone numbers, and they're shared with all organizations, and they do a lot of work with national laws and lobbying and national corporations and things like that. So we're all linked. We all do a similar mission. We're all doing similar work. So it's a matter of working smart and not hard.
Right.
And gaining best practice knowledge from other shelters throughout the country. And we were just really fortunate to be funded recently by the McGregor Fund to do a pilot program in Canton, where we're going to be doing an assessment of high lethality cases that come across the police department's desk, and do some special interventions with special training for the police department, prosecutors, and advocates, and really trying to reduce the domestic violence homicide rate in this particular community. And if we can make the strides that we think we're going to be able to make in that community, we'd like to try to replicate that in our other cities.
Oh,
so we're
terrific.
Using a lot of best practice models that we've you know, learned about from other states,
right.
And we're trying to replicate them and do them here in Southeast Michigan.
Wonderful, wonderful. What about the money? Where does it come from? This is the kind of program that has to take a whole lot of money. And I mean, we talked about a little bit of numbers when we talked about ARC and the playground, but just day-to-day operations,
yeah.
Feeding people.
Well, it does take a lot of money to run our organization. You know, First Step doesn't charge anything for any of our programs. It doesn't charge to have your animal fostered in the ARC. You don't have to pay to be in the shelter. You don't have to pay for your food or you know, pay for counseling or anything like that. So all of our services are provided free of charge.
Okay.
So that does take a significant amount of funds to run. And so we do get some money through state and federal funding sources, through the Department of Human Services, through Department of Housing and Urban Development, things like that. But we're really looking to diversify our funding with more private donations, corporate donations, religious, civic donations, fundraising events. We have a very, very small fundraising staff. So we don't do as a lot of time, we don't spend a lot of time doing fundraisers, but a lot of other groups will do fundraisers and donate the money to us.
Mm-hmm.
So that is just the very best return of investment for us, because we're not spending a lot of money planning golf outings and dinners,
right,
and things like that. So we have other service groups. We just had a great event at Carson's in March that was put on for us by the Zonta Club of Farmington Novi. And they've done this event for us for the last 21 years.
It's
after-hours shopping night.
Oh, okay.
And every year that raises between $15,000 and $25,000 a year for First Step.
Wow.
And that's funds. It's run by another organization. And that money goes directly to fill in the gaps in our budget that happen. So, and then we're always raising money for special projects like the ARC.
Mm-hmm.
Those are, you know, we do these big special projects rarely and occasionally, but the most urgent need is just straight donations that we can fund holes in our budget.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, sometimes we'll get a foundation grant that will pay for a specific project like this McGregor Fund project in Canton. But there's other things, you know, light bill, the heat bill, the you know, those kinds of things that we need to raise funds for. So we get donations from ladies that write little checks, $25 checks a couple times a year. We get Girl Scouts that collect money in honor of their moms for Mother's Day. And
okay.
We have major donors, major gift donors that give us, you know, a significant, several, you know, $50,000, $60,000 gifts to fund special projects.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the gamut. We have, you know, everything from elementary school kids collecting pennies to major gift donors. So we're really, really lucky, fortunate, blessed to have that relationship with the community, that people believe in what we do and support us. But we always know that there's a lot more support that can happen. The more money we can raise, the more people we can reach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can do outreach. We can serve more people. We do believe that there is more people out there that need our help that are just not calling us.
Right.
And that goes for the ARC as well. I mean, we've been in the fundraising mode for the last couple of years, and we've reached out to everyone. A group of children at the school I work at did a Pennies for Pets collection. We made a video, and we sent it to Ellen and Oprah. We haven't gotten any response yet, but we've run the gamut of trying to contact anybody and everybody who has a pet or who loves a pet or has ever had a pet. But it all makes a difference, whether it's large or small. Mm-hmm. It's all adding up.
Yeah, we've gotten some significant gifts from PetSmart.
Correct.
Okay. And so between Elsa's efforts and the committee's efforts and the PetSmart gifts and things, we've raised close to $30,000 for the ARC so far.
Mm-hmm.
But construction costs, we're thinking, are going to cost about probably between $100,000 and $110,000 to get the building built.
Okay.
And then we'll have our program expenses as well. So we do have a little bit ways to go, but we've got some other grant sources out.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also looking for major gift donors that would want to learn more about the project. If anybody wants to come and learn more about First Step or the playground or the ARC committee, they can call me.
Okay.
My number is 734-656-0730. You can also reach me through our website, but we do tours, and if anybody's interested in learning about major gift opportunities, we'd be more than happy to meet with them and provide information about the ARC or whatever specific program they'd be interested in funding.
Okay. Are you ever looking for gifts in kind of some sort? You had mentioned that the children receive a little bag or a little package, and the parents receive a little package. Are you looking to put those together only yourselves, or are you looking for a child's package to come into the ARC, where maybe there's a mail package that has certain types of toys, coloring books, that kind of thing, and maybe a tween girl who's looking for the nail polish and the blush and that sort of thing?
Yeah. Well, we do get a lot of donations that come in the door at First Step. We do take in-kind donations, and it's a significant part of how we're able to provide our programs. So our difficulty is our storage, our lack of storage. And until we get this resource center and ARC built, we don't really have a place to put a lot of stuff. But our most urgent things that we need each and every day is listed on our website. So we have a wish list that's on our website, and we also have a children's wish list. So on that wish list are things like diapers, baby wipes, toilet paper. You know, you don't really think about it, but if you had a house of 50 people, how much toilet paper would you go through in a year? Okay, so we really need people to collect toilet paper, Kleenex tissue, paper towels, those kinds of things that you consume, the consumables you go through every day, garbage bags, those kinds of things. We almost don't spend any money on that stuff because there's so many groups that do drives and they bring those things to us, so that's really an important savings. On our children's wish list, there's things like snack foods, you know, like, you know, fruit snacks and, you know, different, you know, juices and boxes and things like that that kids can use in the summer or when they're on field trips and things. In terms of the in-kind, Elsa's gotten pet kennels donated through the Humane Society.
Yeah, if we don't have a wish list yet, but we're doing collections in preparation for when the ARC opens. So we do have kennels that are in storage for when it opens. My spare bedroom at home is now the ARC room. we've had Girl Scouts who've made pet toys, cat and dog toys for us. We constantly are collecting books regarding animals, so we'll have them housed in the family area of the ARC. When families come in, we're doing a collection of stuffed animals, pet type stuffed animals. So I have tubs and tubs of those things at my home right now, so we'll be ready for when it opens. But I'm sure as we get closer to that grand opening, we'll have a lot more needs, such as dog food, cat food, more things that could spoil if we get them too far ahead of time.
Yeah, and we've actually gotten some very large in-kind gifts. So recently we had a company that said that they would put in the sod for our playground. And also the irrigation system. We've had
that's a big wow.
People, we've had a group from the Henry Ford School of Nursing donated the playground equipment from their site. We went and got volunteers and removed the playground equipment and brought it and relocated it over to First Step because they're not using it as a playground anymore since it's a nursing school.
Right.
So they asked us if we wanted it, and we said sure. So we had volunteers go out with jackhammers and deconstruct the playground and reconstruct it over at our place.
Wow.
And we have everything, including a splash pad, and all that was donated. So it's really a very exciting time for First Step. We squeeze more out of a dime than anybody can humanly possibly squeeze out of it, I think. And then those in-kind donations are really a real critical part of it.
And that's how I got involved with First Step, a group I was involved with, Divine Design, when the new building was about to open. We did an extreme makeover. We turned the what had been a conference room into their dining room in 1 week's time. So we just went in on a Monday, and it was done by the Friday. It was a lot of fun, but it was a great result, and that's how I became aware of the need for the pet shelter. So it grew from there.
Okay. All right. We're going to take a little break, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Hey, I'm Buck. I like to drive a big truck. I like to drive a big truck with big old knobby tires. And when I'm driving around town in my big truck with my big old knobby tires, I like to listen to WHFR radio. I like it because it's different. I like its non-commercial block variety format. You see, some days I may wake up and want to put on my cowboy hat. And some days I might wake up and want to put on a tutu. Well, what I'm trying to say is, some days I might feel like a little rockabilly, or maybe a Broadway musical, or maybe just even a good old-fashioned local news show. WHFR, it's got them all. It's got a ton of choices. It's got more faces than a senior class picture. Take it from me, Buck with a Truck. Check out the big old selections you can get with the station making waves on the web at WHFR.FM and on the dial 89.3 FM WHFR Dearborn.
Hey, what's the big deal? There are tons of non-commercial, wide-open variety formatted radio stations that love to play local music in our area, right? All right, let me take that back.
You know there is only one real radio station here in the Motor City that is non-commercial, plays a wide variety of musical styles, and loves to support and play local music. And we have been doing it for almost 30 years. We are WHFR 89.3 FM in Dearborn, Michigan, from classical to hip-hop and everything in between. We even have great local news and informative talk shows. We have something for just about everyone. So keep your dial set here to WHFR 89.3 FM and WHFR.FM on the internet. We are the only radio station that is really making waves.
Welcome back to Impact, the show about individuals and groups making a positive difference in the community. Man, you guys fit that perfectly. Thank you so much for being here and talking to us about all the wonderful things going on at First Step, the challenges. And I have one last question, and it might be for Teresa, but tell me about one family or one individual, some story, one of your stories that stands out amongst all the others.
Well, it's hard to just pick one because mm-hmm. there's so many people every day, but I think of a woman that had two children in our shelter, horrible case of domestic violence. Now she's working as a baker. She got trained and is a baker at a fancy bakery, and she's learning her skill and her craft. She's still coming in for counseling. She's been through our shelter, our transitional housing programs. Her kids are coming in for counseling still. And she's just told us that her whole life has turned around.
Wow.
She's not in the abusive relationship anymore, and the kids have brightened up, and that burden of stress and violence is off their shoulders, and mm-hmm. they're really able to be happy now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a story that's replicated with many of our survivors, and probably, you know, thousands of survivors since we started back in 1978.
Right. Thank you so much. Any special stories?
I just think about our first donation that we got for the ARC when we started the process, and it was from a woman who had previously stayed at First Step, and she was giving a small donation, all that she could, but because when she was at First Step, she didn't have the opportunity to bring her pet,
mm-hmm.
and she realized what a difference it would have made if she could. So I think that donation just started us on the road, and that means more to me than a large donation, because
right.
that one truly came from the heart,
right.
and it justified what we're trying to accomplish.
Right. Oh, thank you both so much for being here. This is Impact, the show about individuals and groups making a positive difference in the community. And thank you to Mark Hall for producing Impact. Thank you all for listening to Impact, the show about individuals and groups making a positive difference in the community, and you're all doing that in some positive way. The views and opinions expressed on Impact are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio nor Henry Ford College. This is a pre-recorded show. This is WHFR Dearborn.
He puts his money in mason jars and buries them out in the yard. When he's gone, God rest his soul, I'll be looking for all them holes. You can't take it with you when you go.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal, host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. What do you get when you take a bunch of public radio nerds and shut them in a room with computer geeks? Well, in addition to some bizarrely socially awkward offspring, you get the Public Radio Player. It's a new iPhone app that streams hundreds of public radio stations, including this one, straight to your iPhone and iPod Touch. You can get more information at publicradioplayer.org.
You're listening to WHFR.FM, WHFR Dearborn. Yo, guys and dolls out there, this is Daddy G at the Malt Shop inviting you to join us at the Malt Shop. So, hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror and grab your favorite squeeze, because we're going to the Malt Shop back to the 50s. Here we are at the Malt Shop. Here we are back in the 50s.
There's a moon out tonight. Let's go strolling. There's a girl in my heart. Whose heart I've stolen. There's a moon out tonight. Let's go strolling through the park.
Moon out tonight.